Welcome to Season 3 of the Unscripted Medicine Podcast, a podcast by medical students who live and learn at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine.
On the show, we host a variety of discussions such as navigating the preclinical and clinical years, exploring humanism in medicine, and developing our physician identities outside of the textbook.
Check out the show notes or our website for more information, helpful links, resources, and more.
Please connect with us via email or on Twitter at @unscripted_med. We would love to hear from you. We hope you enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to the Unscripted Medicine Podcast. My name is Rachel Holloway, and in today's episode, I chat with Dr. Will Bynum about a topic that I think most medical trainees have experienced at some point: shame in medical education. Dr. Will Bynum received his bachelor's degree at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and obtained his medical degree at the University of South Carolina School of Medicine, where he graduated with AOA and Gold Humanism honors. He completed a National Capital Consortium family medicine residency in the D.C. metro area and spent 7 years on active duty in the U.S. Air Force, including 3 years of his residency training, as well as 4 years as family medicine residency faculty at the same program. He now serves as program director of the Duke University Family Medicine Residency Program, as well as an assistant professor of family medicine. He is currently enrolled as a PhD student in health professions education at Maastricht University. His primary area of academic interest focuses on the influence of self-conscious emotions, i.e. shame, guilt, and pride, in medical education. In addition to researching shame in medical education, he is currently developing innovations to address related challenges, including impaired learner and provider wellness, suboptimal learning environments, and learner mistreatment. He also prides himself in being a father to 2 young boys and a husband to his wife, Carson. It is an honor to have such an esteemed and accomplished clinician, educator, and researcher on the show today. Without further ado, we'll dive right in. Okay, hello. I am on the line with the one, the only, Dr. Will Bynum. Dr. Bynum, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, I'm Will Bynum the fourth, so I'm technically not the one and only. Oh. I'm actually one of 4 Will Bynums. But no, I appreciate the
kind choice of words.
No, thank you for the great intro.
Yeah, this has been a long time coming, trying to get a time down to record, so I'm very happy to sit down with you. We are here to talk about shame in medicine, which seems to be a particular area of focus, expertise for you, Dr. Bynum. So we are lucky to have you on. And we'll just go ahead and dive right in. So Dr. Bynum, would you mind telling the audience a little bit about yourself and interests, hobbies, what you do at Duke, whatever you please?
Sure. And thanks so much for having me. I'm really thrilled at the chance to talk with you and to have a chance to participate in a podcast that I know is oriented towards medical students, who I think is one of the most critical groups for the future of medicine by far. I'm also a big fan of University of Cincinnati with a lot of colleagues there, and what I know is really an amazing place. So thank you for having me. I'm a family medicine physician. I have been in academic medicine my whole career. My interest and really passion for it started at the end, towards the end of medical school, and carried through during residency and beyond. So much so that I would say now I probably associate more as a teacher than I do as a physician, which has been incredible and a bit unexpected. And really more recently have made room for sort of an additional identity as a researcher, which still doesn't quite feel right because I've never seen myself as such, but have begun to believe it, at least. So I'm from North Carolina. I'm currently at Duke University, where I'm the program director of family medicine residency, an amazing program, really dynamic residents, incredible learning and work environments, and just fantastic all around people. I'm a dad of 2 sons, age 2 and 3. You know, they're both the most amazing, inspiring, fun children, and also they just destroy my life on a constant basis, whether it's sleep or, you know, my home or my ego. They're incredible. And my wife, Carson, we've been married for almost 7 years, and she is just an amazing supporter of me and the work I do as well. So, love what I do, and I'm really privileged to have the chance to teach and practice and research in medicine.
Yeah, I have been a faraway admirer of the teaching that you do and the work that you do through Med Twitter for a while now. And so when I was brainstorming opportunities or ideas for podcast episodes, I was like, it would be so cool to have you on just to talk about, you know, what research you do and the work that you're doing over there at Duke. So I'm really excited that, you're here and that you're willing to talk about shaman medicine, because I do feel that, our medical students here at UCOM could definitely benefit from opening the door to this conversation. Especially speaking as a third year who is finishing up her third year. So I have 5 weeks left as of this recording, and, you know, third year and just the first 2 years is just a roller coaster of emotions and adjustments and resiliency. And I felt that, selfishly I could benefit from talking about it. And then also I think a lot of our med students at UC could talk about it. So Dr. Bynum, how did you get interested in researching, you know, shame and other emotions in medicine? How did you get into that?
Yeah, there's a short answer and a long answer. And I'm going to give you the short answer and an abbreviated long answer. The short answer is that I've always been a person that is aware of emotions. So as I reflect back, I'm not surprised that I landed on this topic. I wouldn't have predicted it, but it makes sense. I've just always been an emotionally in touch, intact person, which can be great and it can really suck. I've maybe just found a way to leverage that passion, towards building something meaningful. Where it was specifically catalyzed, this interest in shame, was through a shame experience, or really a couple of experiences that happened in residency. One was, you know, a clinical experience during an OB rotation where I was an early second year resident, so kind of early senior resident with newfound responsibility. And long story short, I made a really challenging and significant error during a childbirth that caused a pretty severe maternal injury and led to just a major emotional response that even for someone who's, you know, emotionally in touch and aware, it really threw me off kilter for a significant amount of time. And it took a lot of time and unpacking to discover what I was going through, which turned out to be shame. Around the same time, I was also just getting out of a bad relationship, frankly. And in the recovery from that, which was one of the most growth inspiring periods of my life, that's when I really discovered shame, through Brené Brown's work, who, you know, I don't need to probably pitch her. Most people found everyone knows who she is for good reason. Yeah. I'm a huge fan. And the reason I love her work so much is that she makes this challenging topic very real and accessible and normal and cool even. And so I discovered it through her, and in so doing saw myself as having been in a state of chronic shame, personally, which was jarring for me, but also it was really empowering because then I could do something about it. So once this construct came onto my radar through these personal experiences, I had a natural response, in terms of looking at the environments, the relationships, the experiences going on around me, and realizing that this emotion was not just limited or unique to me as a person, but it was actually quite common, yet no one was talking about it.
Yeah, I feel like having not gone through residency yet, not really having that position of decision-making and power, I think a lot about like experiencing those things in residency. And I also think there is a lot of shame in undergraduate, like in the first and second and third years of med school as well. And so I really appreciate you sharing that moment of shame and that period of your life with us, because I think that it normalizes it a little bit.
So you're exactly right. I mean, that the taboo, stigmatized, unspoken, yet remarkably powerful and painful nature of shame is what makes these discussions so important.
Yeah. And I think before we move forward anymore in this discussion, I think it would be beneficial to step back and define what shame exactly is. Because like you, I am familiar with Brené Brown. But even myself, you know, shame is this elusive topic that not everyone talks about. So how would you define shame, Dr. Bynum?
I'm going to draw from psychology, and at its most sort of simple definition would be to conceptualize shame as an emotional state that occurs when a person engages in a self-evaluation and assesses themselves to be globally flawed, deficient, or unworthy in some way. It typically, but not always, responds to a triggering event, and as a part of the self-evaluation that follows, we consider who we are and how we view ourselves in the moment in response to that triggering event. And then we compare that to a standard or a set of standards that help characterize our ideal selves, who we wish we could have been in that moment, who we're striving to become. And upon realizing that we have failed to reach those standards in light of this triggering event, we then place blame for that on something global, stable, difficult to change about ourselves, as opposed to something more specific, behavioral, action-based, or circumstantial, situational. And that set of attributions more aligns with a guilt response. So when we feel shame, as Brené Brown really says it best, we conclude that, you know, we are bad, I am bad, there's something wrong with me, the person, versus when we feel guilt, I did a bad thing, I'm not proud of that necessarily, but me, the whole person, is not implicated in this triggering event.
That's a really important distinction to make, because I almost feel that if you attribute these mistakes or flaws, so to say, to your personal self and your worth as a person, it's much harder to respond and be resilient to that hit. Whereas with the guilt, it's more like I did these steps that were wrong. Here's how I'm going to fix it in the future. And so what I'm hearing is it almost sounds like guilt is more conducive to a growth mindset, if I can use those buzzwords in this conversation.
Definitely. So, and there's psychological theory to support that. We actually have some qualitative research that provides some empiric support for that relationship. I like to think about it in terms of therefore statements. I have an amazing mentor, Lara Varpio, who drilled the concept of what's the therefore statement? You know, why does this matter, or what comes next? And this helps me understand and conceptualize the difference between shame and guilt in terms of our action tendencies. If you assess yourself to be flawed in some global way, so I'm incompetent, I'm not smart enough, I'm not attractive enough, I'm not hardworking enough, I'm not good enough as a student, as a person, the therefore statement that follows is I have to change something global about myself in order to be, to reach that standard that I'm trying to achieve, or to fix the what triggered this evaluation. Whereas when I feel guilt and attribute it to something more specific that I can change. So, I made a bad mistake. I overslept my alarm. I, just am new to this procedure or to this topic, et cetera. Therefore I need to come up with a new morning routine. I need to learn more about this topic. I need to practice this procedure more. I need to get more experience. So what follows the therefore in both of those aligns with the nature of the self-evaluation. If it's something much more global, then we look for more global fixes, which are often very hard to find, particularly in a shame state where you're already seeing yourself as deficient in some way, versus focusing on something actionable and specific as the cause of a transgression or a failure naturally points us to specific things that we can do to get ourselves closer to who it is we're trying to become. And insofar as, you know, that's the set of action tendencies that follow, it actually makes guilt tend to be a more growth-orienting, pro-engagement, pro-learning emotion that may fuel a growth mindset. So I believe that I can do better at this thing or improve in this way, and I have a specific way to do that. I'm going to go about doing it. Versus shame really facilitating more of a fixed mindset where if I believe I'm not worthy or I'm not good enough or I can never be good enough at this, then my struggle with it or my failure only proves that belief that I have that is fixed about myself and can further induce shame because I just more deeply believe that I'm not capable of doing it.
Yeah. So I personally can think of some examples in which I felt shame during third year and during the first 2 years of med school. But Dr. Bynum, you've done a lot of, you know, research and workshops with undergraduate medical education, aka medical students, on shame. And I'm wondering what kind of things you've heard from students about how they experience shame, just to, you know, provide some examples.
There are a lot. I'll try to group them. And I'll pull from really research in residents, medical students, and pre-medical students. Not surprisingly, among residents, the most sort of potent shame triggers were those related to patient care. So particularly errors, and especially those errors that led to severe harm or the death of a patient. And we had a couple stories in which that occurred. And the shame that could follow was really profound. And I've directly experienced that. We also found a lot of shame related to learning across all three cohorts. And it's a little alarming, to be honest. The alarming part, well, it's alarming in two ways. One is that we've identified a lot of shame related to events during learning that would be considered normal learning events or inevitable learning events. So you don't know an answer when you get caught on in public, or you bomb a presentation, right? Especially if you're early in your training. You say something stupid on rounds. You struggle on a test. You're below average. All of those events are what I would consider to be very normal in a learning process. They suck, but they're normal. And yet they cause significant shame. And it seemed that in causing shame, people were often unprepared for the emotional impact of those events. And we can also talk about the standards against which they self-assessed during those events, because that's also an important component. But the other alarming set of triggers related to learning were those that we consider to not be normal in learning or not be inevitable and be inappropriate, frankly, like being mistreated, being pimped. I hate that term, but it's everybody knows what it means, sort of interrogated to the point of humiliation, being marginalized on a team, being ignored in a learning environment, derogated by peers, that those experiences were occurring while learning medicine, which is, if you just stop and think about that for a second, should be a real cognitive dissonance there. And not surprisingly, they cause a lot of shame. So the other component of shame related to learning is that related to assessment. And this is a critical, I think, facet of this experience, in that we found a lot of shame, especially earlier on in medical school and in pre-medical students, related to objective performance. So not scoring above or way above the class average on a test, scoring below it, MCAT scores, step one preparation, even not even the exam itself, shelf tests, et cetera, such that lower scores could lead to major shame feelings, which over time we've kind of come to understand and identify a relationship between self-worth and objective performance. And that's something we can talk about more if you'd like. I think we're really exploring some of the origins of that in early education. The last thing I just want to mention, I'll just say, this is not an exhaustive list of all the shame triggers, but an area that has really emerged much more in the medical student and pre-med studies has been around the experience of being underrepresented in some way in your environment, whether that's through demographic factors, race, ethnicity, gender, identity, sexual orientation, or if it's just some way that you perceive yourself to be outside the norm or are, such as where you're from in the country, what sort of undergrad institution you went to, whether you dress a certain way, that experience of being outside of the dominant norm seems to both fuel shame or amplify existing shame, or in some people trigger it outright from something as simple as walking through the front door of medical school on day one.
Yeah. I have a few different points I wanted to make sure that I hit on from what you just said, but I think all of that is so great. The first thing I'll say is that one of the things I wanted to ask you about was being, you know, an underrepresented group within a learning environment and how that plays a role into feelings of shame. What I'm hearing and what I've talked to other medical students about is that when you feel psychologically unsafe, whether that, you know, seeds shame in a person who didn't already have that baseline, or if it amplifies pre-existing shame, I think that when you feel psychologically unsafe, it leads to more of these emotions, and it leads to, you know, deficient learning. Like, you're not there for what you are supposed to be there for. You're not in an environment in which you feel you can ask questions or be wrong. You feel like you have to constantly prove yourself.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to say about this. The first thing I want to say and acknowledge is that as a white man in medicine, this is not a lived experience that I've had. And I am, you know, increasingly aware of the fact that I don't experience shame as a white man in medicine, because everywhere I go, I'm in the dominant norm, or I'm represented by those dominant norms. And that if that's not a form of privilege, I don't know what is. There's actually an emotional privilege that comes with being a member of the dominant norm. So anything I'm going to say right now is reflections as a researcher and as a program director, and really an ally to people who do have lived experiences that I've learned from, but I can never fully comment on or capture in my comments. So a couple things just briefly in response to what you said. One is that for individuals outside of the norms that have become standard over the course of time in medicine or any institution, that can translate to a lot of assimilation pressure to align with those norms. And that can translate into more global aspects of the self. So I need to be more of this type of person and less of this type of person. I have to, you know, dress more like this and less like this. I have to talk more like this and less like this. All of which stifles authentic self-expression and engenders the idea that some aspect of who I am as a person is not acceptable here or not good enough for this environment. So the assimilation pressure, I think, is massive. Again, not something I've ever experienced. Second, the need to prove oneself, I think, is amplified when the system has told you, and especially if you believe and have internalized, that your being there may be a mistake. And this is where imposter syndrome really comes into play, and it has links to shame. Where if I'm, you know, we have research participants, I'll just tell you their stories, you know, black male from an HBCU, HBCU, say that right, who was admitted to a top 10 competitive medical school, and coming into medical school had serious pervasive intrusive doubts about whether he really belonged and whether his admission was real. Whether, as he said, was it a product of some special system that was designed to have people like me in this environment? And there was a lot of imposter syndrome wrapped up in that. What that then translated into was a very powerful need to prove himself as worthy of that admission decision, in which he experienced greater pressure potentially than someone who was represented in that environment, who did not have to second guess whether they belonged. That then catalyzed in a shame reaction at the first sign of struggle. So normal learning struggle, but that then waters the seed essentially. And what blossoms is, no, I am not supposed to be here. I was a product of a mistaken system. I am not worthy. And then that deepening that the fear that I don't belong here, that I'm not good enough, that then can drive all sorts of behaviors that we know shame contributes to. But if you think about the extra cognitive load, emotional impact, energy that has to be put into overcoming those feelings, and all of the institutionalized racism and bias and microaggressions that people had to experience, shame, I think, might be part of the iceberg of being different outside of a dominant norm, underrepresented, that we're not yet recognizing.
Yeah, that is so insightful. And I am also, you know, a cis white female, so I cannot fully, you know, speak to any sort of experience like that either. But that is so insightful to hear all of the challenges and how they just pile up and how it's kind of this like shame snowball into this really hard experience. And it makes me think about, you know, the importance of representation in medicine and how individuals from a URM status really benefit when there is someone that they can be mentored by and sponsored by who look like them, who speak like them, who they can identify with. And I wonder if that helps to combat the shame experience a little bit.
Yeah, so this maybe gets to a bigger point that I might make, which is that representation is a necessary but far insufficient factor in terms of creating the safe, inclusive, equitable environments that our profession demands and that leaders must create. And so what you're talking about is going beyond representation and going, you know, into the actual functioning of the environment, its values, its norms, its standards, its affordances, and really looking at what is the chance that any given person in an environment can feel a true sense of belonging, can feel mm-hmm. safe engaging in the incredible risks of learning medicine and the incredible rigor of it, and authentically self-express in a way that really allows us to become the competent, empathic, you know, functional physicians that the system's trying to create. And so something like having people in an environment that, you know, have similar life experiences as me, that have experienced institutionalized structures in similar ways as me, that mm-hmm. can relate to my experiences as whoever I am, is critical. But what it just hasn't been the case for large groups of people in our community. Mm-hmm. And even within communities where there is greater representation, we are still fighting against structural and ideological norms that mm-hmm. impede that sort of authentic self-expression and belonging. So the bottom line is, as we diversify, and if we're going to continue to rightly diversify and increase representation in the healthcare system, which is critical, we have mm-hmm. got to pay triple the amount of attention to what those environments are actually like for the people who pass through our doors.
Mm. And how do you feel that we can go about assessing those environments and changing those environments? It sounds like it's a really complex, multi-layered, systematic issue, but you know, there's got to be steps that we can take.
Yes, I'll zoom out a little bit and just say, you know, another way of sort of framing that question is, how do we attend to the role of shame in medical education? You know, and that has significant implications for what we're talking about with underrepresentation. It has implications for learning, well-being, patient care, because I'm going to argue that shame is a deeply embedded emotion within the practice, mm-hmm. in the profession. And that's not necessarily mm-hmm. a bad thing. I mean, I don't want to say we have this massive, huge shame problem. I mean, I think we have a shame problem, and I'll explain what I mean by that in a minute. But but having embedded shame is normal. I mean, because it's a normal emotion. And it's mm-hmm. even more normal, or at least expected, in medical education because of the nature of what we do and what mm-hmm. we're trying to do. So, you know, perfectionism is a laudable goal. And if you ask any patient, especially, I'm not a surgeon, but if I was, I guarantee you that any given patient wants me to be perfect for them, right?
Yeah.
You can make a mistake, just do it on someone else. But so, but that's impossible. So we are held to perfectionist standards, or we hold ourselves to them. We work in incredible uncertainty where failure is inevitable, bad outcomes are inevitable, people are going to die, sometimes mm-hmm. by our hand, and often, mm-hmm. you know, in spite of the great things we do. And then we, our self-evaluation and how we view ourselves as people is hanging in the balance. Mm-hmm. Not to mention that we've all been products of a system that have pushed us to the upper echelons of achievement and performance. Mm-hmm. And we've come to rely on that to know ourselves as people. So there is shame embedded in the natural experience of learning and practicing something like medicine. And mm-hmm. and I think we got to recognize that and grapple with it in a way that helps people engage with it healthfully. We also have embedded shame that has been propagated, instilled and propagated as a way to maintain power, to reinforce hierarchy, to stratify, to ensure the persistence of cultural and institutional norms, that has been used as a strategy for teaching, wrongly. But, you know, I think we have a deep culture of shame-based teaching in health professions mm-hmm. education, all of which has led this emotion to flourish very, very quietly and silently. Yet it's kind of like a raging fire with no smoke or heat, you know, but it's still destroying mm-hmm. or it's still causing destruction. And so the bigger question is that we have to grapple with, that I think feeds into a lot of different topics, is how do we engage with this embedded shame in a way that orients us towards growth and well-being and connection and community and mitigates its more destructive potential?
Yeah, absolutely. You said some things that really hit home with me about, you know, perfectionism. I think most people who go into medicine are type A personalities and have worked really, really hard to get to where we are today. And there is an aspect of perfectionism in everyone. And I think when you work so hard to get to a place like med school and like residency and as an attending, you work so hard to get there, you kind of start to identify yourself as medicine. And I've talked a lot on the podcast and also just in my personal life about having aspects to yourself that are not within medicine and kind of grounding yourself outside of medicine. I think that it becomes really toxic when you identify and you base all of your worth as, you know, your performance in medicine. And I think that shame, when you inevitably experience it in medicine, it almost is like admitting weakness. And I think that's why people don't want to talk about it. And I think that's why it's a fire without smoke, is because it's everyone experiences it, but no one wants to talk about it because it's admitting that you are not perfect.
Yeah. Oh, there's so much there in what you just said. The first thing I'm just going to say is that what a crazy standard we hold for ourselves and each other is to be perfect. I think we actually hold ourselves much more to that standard than we do each other. But if we're experiencing silent shame because expressing what is a normal human emotion makes us seem weak, how are we defining being strong in medicine? And that is where I think we're kind of screwed up, frankly. We have these warped conceptualizations of what it means to be quote unquote strong or stable or whatever it is that are inhuman, frankly. They're just inhuman and they're ridiculous. And yet we do it anyway. So there's another cognitive dissonance there that, and ironically, in a profession where we engage with people's inherent humanity and the inherent failures of the human condition all the time, we somehow think we can escape that ourselves. It's actually quite egotistical, frankly, you know?
It's like a God complex in medicine.
A little bit. I mean, yeah, or at least... if it's not a God complex, it's a self-flagellation in a way, because it's not that we all necessarily walk around thinking we're God. It's that we punish ourselves when we're anything but God. And it's that self-punishment or that the shame that we feel from being human that I think can be particularly destructive. And the flip side of that is that there may be real power in allowing ourselves to be more imperfect, more flawed. And then even beyond that, maybe celebrating it is as counterproductive as that sounds. I think, God, what if we all got together and talked about the things we sucked at instead of, you know, constantly trying to, you know, polish our CVs one notch higher. I think the standards are really, really tough that we hold ourselves to.
Kind of along similar lines as, you know, standards, you talked earlier, something I wanted to circle back to was objective measurements of success in medicine. I think that a big conversation recently, especially at University of Cincinnati College of Medicine, is the biases that go into grading third year and the discrepancies between grading and performance and how it's not always reflective of the quality of doctor that you'll be at the end of the day. Our clinical skills instructor, Dr. Matt Kelleher, and some other awesome medical education researchers at UCOM have been researching competency-based medical education and the role of pass-fail in student wellness and student success, and like how we can reach competency for residency without grades. And it's like this novel concept, but it in theory is, you know, trying to combat this system in which we shouldn't strive for grades. We should strive to embody these qualities and these competencies that are actually going to make us successful, because grades might not do that at the end of the day. And so, Dr. Bynum, I wanted to ask you what your thoughts were on, you know, grades and these objective measurements of success and how they can contribute to the shame spiral.
So I have a lot to say about this. I'll want to first by giving a shout out to Ben Kinnear. Hi, Ben. I'm one of Ben's biggest fanboys, if he doesn't know it.
Me too.
And all the folks, yeah, the assessment work that's going on at Cincinnati is cutting edge. I mean, it's leading edge, and it's so cool to see. So I'll talk a little bit about maybe the emotional underside of that. And I'm going to link it to something you were just talking about in terms of having things that make us who we are outside of just medicine. So as we have studied shame in pre-medical students, and in medical students, we've identified shame as a destabilizing emotional state. And as we've dug more deeply into what that means, we've come to understand that what appears to be most destabilized by shame is what's called self-concept. And so self-concept is a construct from psychology that is defined most simply as, what do you think about when you think about yourself? And it's been described as being comprised of our identity and our contingencies of self-esteem. So on what things does our self-worth rely? On what is it contingent? What makes us feel good about ourselves? We've identified, like I mentioned earlier, a strong relationship between objective performance and performance in general and self-worth. And there's a term for that in psychology called performance-based self-esteem. So this is a specific contingency of self-esteem that depends on my perceived level of objective performance or performance. And so if I perform at a high level, if I get a high score, it makes me feel good about myself. Importantly, to continue feeling good about myself, especially as I put more and more self-worth on my performance, which happens as I shed these other things about me, my hobbies, my, you know, being a musician, the things I love to do, my relationships, that puts more and more weight from my self-worth on my performance. Sustaining that self-worth requires continued levels of high performance. That is metaphysically impossible in medicine, right? Whether it's a score or it's more subjective performance, you cannot perform at a consistently top or high level all the time, and which is should be fine. That should be fine. Where it's precarious is if our self-worth is so dependent on that performance that when we struggle to maintain that impossible level, we then our self-worth then takes a hit. And that's where shame comes in. So it started with residents. We identified performance-based self-esteem. We then identified it much more in medical students insofar as it seems that this reliance on objective scores to feel good about myself seems to develop before residency. Turns out it develops before medical school. As we learned in pre-medical students, it actually probably develops before pre-medical training, and for many people in early education. I mean, we have research participants who talked about, if I would only receive clear love from my parents when I scored well, or when I was a top student, or when I got into medical school. Otherwise, I didn't feel loved by them, or I would get rewarded for grades. My parents would dispense pride towards me or express pride in me when I got grades. And then that just gets reinforced over and over and over by a system that so heavily relies on scores for high stakes admissions decisions, residency, medical school, for stratification, et cetera, that we then internalize as people. What's screwy about that is that when we look at medical school admissions, we put an insane value on the role of scores in terms of assessing someone's candidacy to medical school. And ultimately what you're assessing is their potential as a physician, right? That's ultimately what we should be assessing in medical school admissions. And yet we're using a small subset of specific scores to make those determinations. And that drives a set of values and behaviors in pre-medical students towards achieving those scores, often at the expense of those more well-rounded aspects of ourselves that we have to sacrifice. That then is carried through the gates of medicine, you know, into medical school, where it may be reinforced further, especially if we continue needing those high scores. And then we take that out into the profession where we have a real values misalignment, where making a score, studying in the library to ace a shelf test and get honors does not translate into what patients need from us as physicians, at least directly. Now, yeah, you need to know things. I'm not saying we get rid of all testing, right? We have to ensure that you know things and you can learn. But the degree to which the importance of objective performance is internalized, I think sets us up for a misalignment of values needed in the profession itself. So when you look at competency-based self-assessment, or not self-assessment, but competency-based assessment, I see more of an alignment in those values with the ways in which we are assessing people's development of competence. As opposed to saying, you got a 90 on this test, you're going to be a great doctor. We say, you know, are you developing professionalism, ability to communicate interprofessionally, medical knowledge, patient care skills, systems-based practice, all these things that really align more with what's needed in the profession and help detach us from the significant role of grades.
That was a lot. I mean, yes. First of all, I think that you just provided a psychoanalysis for every person's childhood. Mine and included. I think everyone can probably relate to that. The second thought I had was that I think what you just said speaks really to, I think a manifestation of what you just said was, you know, step one, going pass fail, and how it really made everyone kind of scramble, because prior to that, our understanding was that if you did well in step one and step two, you'd be a strong candidate for residency. And now that they've changed it from grades to pass fail, people are like, what do I do in order to make myself competitive? And there's a whole discussion about, you know, prisoner's dilemma and stuff like that, that Dr. Warm at UCIM also gives. But I think that people are kind of reevaluating what makes you a strong competitive applicant to residency. And my personal opinion is that you should be well-rounded. But some people are not looking at it the same way. So I think that that's a really, really pertinent manifestation of what you just said and how we, you know, value grades to be an indicator of our competency.
I think that we have a lot of fear in diminishing our use of scores, because I think we believe that scores somehow tell us we're making the right decision about a person, when in reality there's not a right decision. There's just a whole lot of people that we have committed to making into great physicians as a system, right? Mm-hmm. As a system, we all should be committed to the same mission of creating competent physicians for the public. When we let our own ego and institutional prestige and need to have a certain, you know, average MCAT score in a class or USMLE score, we're pitting ourselves against other institutions and person against person, and we're losing sight of that broader mission towards the public. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, when you look at step one, going past fail is a great thing. I mean, there are so many reasons that needed to happen. I don't think that's going to fix the problem ultimately, because it's not a step one issue. There's a bigger condition or disease at play, which is our insane reliance on scores to feel like we're making the right decision about people.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that just because we made step one, I say we like I was involved in it, like step one went pass fail, I think that it's just going to shift the emphasis to step two, to the MCAT, to what medical school you go to. I think there's all of these repercussions of these unintended repercussions of making step one pass fail. But something else I wanted to mention too was a shift that I've kind of almost, you know, I've had to make, and the other third year medical students have had to make during third year. And it's the shift from basing our performance on our like objective numerical evaluations and more so asking for feedback from our preceptors, and you know, taking that feedback and implementing it moving forward and using that more of a measure of how we're doing and what we can improve upon, because that's going to be, at the end of the day, what happens when we are in residency. It's going to happen when we're in attending. Like, we don't have grades forever, so eventually we have to make that transition to using feedback and not basing ourselves on grades.
Yeah, so this is a challenging transition emotionally. And I mean, I can say that as a learner and, you know, attending. I can definitely say it from our research. Going from objective to subjective in terms of assessment, grading, feedback, your own performance and your assessment of your performance can be really challenging, especially if you've really come to rely on scores, which we all do. One of the nice things about scores is that they're concrete. It's cut and dry. It's objective. You got this score, and that then typically translates into this, you know, conclusion about yourself. So when you think about this at a self-evaluative level, grades are concrete markers, and they're really convenient in A, knowing how I'm doing, and B, knowing how I'm doing relative to everybody else. When you get out of the grades-based environment into the clinical setting, that objectivity goes away, and now things are subjective. And what that means at a deeper emotional, self-conscious emotional level is that I am now making a lot of my own internal assessments about the information that I'm receiving and what it means for me and how it causes me to view myself. Whereas before I just had a grade, and maybe that grade was bad, but at least I knew how to view myself. Now I'm trying to figure out what it means. And so what we find in our research is that we are naturally oriented, I think, in medicine, for whatever reason, towards overly harsh self-assessment. You know, we take these subjective pieces of feedback. It's the classic thing. You get here 10 things you did well and one thing you didn't, and all you really pay attention to or internalize is the one thing you didn't do well, right? That can fuel shame. And shame, this is more important, being in a shame state, or, you know, having a sense of imposterism, or having a deep-seated sense of inadequacy, can really skew that frame of reference when it comes to our self-assessment in a subjective setting. So when I made the error on OB, it was during a vacuum assist delivery. I caused a terrible maternal vaginal laceration. It was really bad. It seemed way worse than it should have been, and I think everyone in the room would agree. But it was during a placental abruption. The baby's heart rate was in the 90s and the 80s. It was dying. There was blood everywhere. I had never done a vacuum assist delivery before. It was totally chaotic. I'd been up for 24 hours. My skewed frame of reference following that event was that I was the worst. I was a person that hurt people. I was incompetent. I was not to be trusted. I was not good enough by any measure, and that I really didn't know how I was going to show back up. Objectively speaking, the objective reality would say you were learning something new in one of the most difficult environments to learn it, and there was a really bad outcome. Maybe there was a component of error there, but it also could have just happened to anybody. That's how the non-shamed me would have seen it, right? But me in the shame state only saw how crappy I was as a person and how responsible I was. And so that's called the skewed frame of reference. And that gets exacerbated, I believe, in a subjective environment, particularly in a hierarchy, when you're receiving feedback from someone who you really trust or whose, you know, opinion that really matters. And it becomes much easier to only hear the bad things, or especially if they're giving you the feedback in a suboptimal manner, right? And there are bad teachers out there, frankly, or they're great teachers that don't know how to give good feedback. Let's put it that way. It can be very easy to believe and internalize the negative aspects of that feedback and let that turn into a shame reaction, if you're already sort of down on yourself.
Yeah. First of all, I can't imagine being in that kind of situation in that OB environment. And I haven't done OB yet. It's one of the few things I haven't done. So we shall see. But that does, you know, it sounds very chaotic. I wonder, Dr. Bynum, how, like, I want to shift the conversation, I think, to shame resiliency, because I do feel like that is a tangible point of action for medical students who are experiencing shame in pre-meds and residents. And I think that building the skill of shame resilience is something that can go a really long way. And so for you personally in that situation, how did you come back from that feeling of shame? And maybe we can talk a little bit about shame resiliency in general.
Yeah. This is the most important part of anything that we're going to talk about, because it's what do you actually do about all this? I'll maybe just provide a definition of shame resilience first. I sort of borrow this maybe from Brené Brown, as well as some other literature, and then my own spin on it. I would consider shame resilience to be the ability and willingness to recognize shame and engage with it constructively, or at least proactively, in a way that build self-concept and orients towards growth. Okay, so it's not what shame resilience is not is figuring out how not to experience shame, or figuring out how to repress or suppress shame. Sometimes we have to repress or suppress it just to get through a day or a procedure or whatever. But shame resilience is the ability to encounter it and then constructively engage with it. And while that is described as sort of an individual level construct, I'll have to say that it's absolutely facilitated by the nature of the environment around you, or hindered by it. So there are environmental affordances and facilitators of shame resilience that are critical. So the answer here is, don't just be more resilient in an environment that is set up to shame you. We have to focus on both. As a part of individual level shame resilience, though, the first thing I'll say is, don't deny the emotion. So, and then the flip side of that is, acknowledge it. So develop awareness of what shame is, what it feels like, what the self-talk is like for yourself and for the people around you. So that, one of the most fundamental, I think, skills with practicing shame resilience is just recognizing when you're in shame state, or having some, or figuring out how to get someone else to help you recognize it. It can be hard to see it in yourself. So that requires reaching out for help. And or developing your own internal mechanism for saying, oh, this is a shame reaction. That's why this sucks so bad. You know, this, that explains it. And that's how it is for me. I know it's shame when I'm really feeling my worst. And I don't often know it until I pause and say, what am I feeling right now? And often what I'll do is try to think about how I'm viewing myself. Once you sort of have identified a shame state, it really is so important to reach out, because oftentimes we cannot unskew that frame of reference ourselves. It's just too hard. Our shame is too entrenched. The voice in our head that says we're not good enough is too loud. And it can be very easy to deflect evidence to the contrary. And I know that personally, and we definitely know that empirically. So once you've reached out, or if you're a supporter of someone and you are being reached out to, or you're proactively trying to help someone, you need to name the shame. So it's just very helpful to be able to say, this is a real emotion. It sucks. It's brutal. It's no fun, but this is what I'm dealing with. And to know that it's normal in a way, or at least it's understandable. And then you can engage with it. So that's all just getting to the point of engagement. I think once the shame is sort of acknowledged and you're aware of it, the ultimate goal is to shift the blame. So off of yourself and onto something you can fix. I mean, that's shame resilience 101. So if you want to, practice shame resilience yourself, that's what you do. If you want to support someone through a shame experience, you got to help them do that. Is to say, practice self-compassion. I need you to stop beating yourself up here. Right? You're a good resident. You're a compassionate, caring person who had a terrible thing happen and maybe had a part in it, but stop beating yourself up. And it's where self-love comes in, and it's where having mentorship and support in an environment can be critical, because sometimes you need someone that you trust and that you believe in to make you believe in your own worthiness, and to stop beating yourself up. And then focusing on something you can fix. And oftentimes we need a map, to figure out what I can fix next. And that's where soliciting feedback, going to trusted mentors and saying, okay, I'm getting over this shame experience, or I'm trying to not beat myself up, but I just don't know how to fix this thing that made me feel this way. Can you help me? And so as attendings, as colleagues, as senior residents, we have to position ourselves in trusting relationships with those people around us so that they can come to us and they can open up and do that. And that's where we get to the environment. We're never going to facilitate environments where that happens naturally or organically if we're still hyper-competitive, if it's psychologically unsafe, if people are getting yelled at or mistreated, or if there's overt or microaggressions. The environment has to facilitate the sharing and the trust, which then happens among people. The other thing I'll just mention, I really love this this framing for medical students in particular, is it gets to the notion of performance. And so I think in our second study, performance, the word came up like 200 plus times in the study. So it was just an overused word. And as I thought about that, I realized we're not using the right word when we say performance. No one in medical school is performing anything. You're rehearsing, right? So performance is a polished product. Performance comes about through repetitive cycles of practice and rehearsal. And eventually you got to perform, right? You got to perform for a patient every time you see them. It's still going to be a flawed performance at times. But when you're learning something, you are not performing, even if it feels like it. So you're on rounds and you're presenting, that's rehearsal. You know, it's painful to fall on your face and to struggle during that rehearsal. But if you allow yourself to be in rehearsal, then struggle that occurs as a part of that practice in rehearsal is normal. And actually, it's important, because the more things you screw up in rehearsal, the more things you can improve for performance. If we go into rehearsal scared and timid and avoiding all mistakes, that's not a very functional or useful rehearsal. So allowing yourself to be in rehearsal can be kind of a game changer. Now, where it gets tricky is in residency, I think. Especially like procedural residency, surgeons, anesthesia, et cetera. The notion of rehearsing when you're the primary surgeon with an attending backing you up is a little bit precarious. But at least conceptualizing yourself in rehearsal, insofar as you give yourself the grace and the leeway in the room to be an imperfect learner, I think has real value.
Mm. I love that reframing from performance to rehearsal. I think that if you can go into a situation and view it as a space in which you can make mistakes and it be okay, because, you know, it's not the end of the road for you. I think that that can be so helpful for, you know, growing and learning. A few other things that you said that really stood out to me was that, first, the practice of self-reflection and understanding and just being mindful of how you speak to yourself in your own inner thoughts can be game changing, because if you're talking to yourself and you're constantly berating yourself in your head, you're going to be much more, you know, prone to feelings like shame. Whereas if you are more encouraging and you talk to yourself like you would talk to your best friend, then it might be a little bit more positive of an experience. The other thing that stood out to me that you said, Dr. Bynum, was that reaching out to other people who make you feel safe and who you trust is really important. I could go to any random person on the street and be like, please validate my feelings and please tell me how I'm okay and how I'm good. And it probably wouldn't mean as much as if I went to someone who was in the experience with me, who I trust and have a good relationship with. If they tell me these things that combat my shame feelings, then I'm much more likely to believe them and to help move on from that stage of shame resilience. So I thought those were really good points that I wanted to emphasize, because I think that those are things that anyone, no matter what stage of training they're in, can practice starting today.
And those things need to be cultivated. I mean, it doesn't take necessarily a ton of cultivation. We have a story from our research of a student on a pediatrics rotation, chronic shame experience due to perceived underperformance. She was exhibiting some withdrawal and disengagement, and a number of people came to her to try to help her, and she deflected each one. And finally, one resident got through to her, right? And she agreed to meet that resident for coffee. They sat down and she opened up about how she was feeling about herself, being down on herself, all her performance. And the resident really helped unskew that frame of reference and reframe her perspective. And the shame dissolved overnight. And the engagement and wellness, really, and mood changes that followed were really profound. And so I got really excited when I heard this story. And I said, well, okay, what was it about that resident compared to the four other people? And she just said, I just trusted that she cared about me. And I said, well, how did she build that trust with you? And she said, it wasn't much. I had only known her as long as anybody else. But on the first day when we met, she asked my name. She asked where I was from. She showed genuine interest in who I am as a person. And she made me feel like a part of the team. That little bit of kind treatment in an environment in which that kindness is not always guaranteed made all the difference for this person accepting the support she needed. And maybe that's a good place to end when it comes to resilience in an environment is, I mean, just kindness, right? And mutual concern for one another's well-being, respect, just trying to take care of one another and then be willing to have ourselves taken care of when it's our turn.
Yeah, I love that. I think that is a really great place to start rounding out the conversation. And I think that, you know, anyone can start with just a little bit of kindness and reaching out to other people and also being the person who is that sounding board, who is that that voice of reason for someone who might be experiencing shame. So I love that. Thank you, Dr. Bynum. Any other thoughts or resources that might be useful for listeners that who want to learn more about shame in medicine?
Yeah, I mean, I think the last couple of thoughts are, you know, talk about this stuff. The medicine, I think, needs a paradigm shift in terms of the way that we treat ourselves and one another, the environments we create, the emotions we allow, the distress we allow and talk about. I think that the way that change is going to ultimately take root is through students and residents. Your generation, who are going to be more willing to talk about these things and are more willing to demand a more humane, kinder, you know, values aligned system. So I just want to encourage you to continue this conversation. You know, we have a website, theshameconvo.com, that has some resources on it, a film, a couple graphic medicine pieces. The Shame and Medicine Project out of the UK is a really good resource. My colleague Luna Dolezal, who I work with quite a bit, they're running an amazing project exploring all sorts of dimensions of shame in healthcare that are fantastic. Brené Brown's TED Talks or books, I mean, any of those, if you're just having a bad day, it's just a great place to go. And then I think just relying on one another. I mean, you know, you're your own best expert at your emotions, believe it or not. Sometimes you just need someone to help you process them and to share that experience with. And then the last thing I'll say is just, we need to make room for additional contingencies of self-esteem and self-worth within this experience. They don't have to be grand, but is there one thing you can do that makes you feel like who you are as a person and good about yourself that has nothing to do with medical school, your education, that you can make just a little room for, right? Just one thing. Can you make that a challenge for yourself in the next few weeks and see if you can find a way to sustain that? That might be a small step towards finding that sort of stable self-concept over time. So that's it for me. And I just really appreciate the chance to have been here. Thanks so much.
I love that. Thank you so much for all of those resources, Dr. Bynum. We will link all of those in the show notes. Dr. Bynum, thank you so much. This was so enlightening and such a great conversation. And I think that our listeners will really benefit from, you know, talking about shame and thinking about just bringing a little bit of humanism back to medicine. So thank you, Dr. Bynum.
Thanks, Rachel. And to any of you who listen, keep up the fantastic work you're all doing, and all my best.